for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Senate approved a spending bill over the weekend, averting a government shutdown. Today, we talk about several provisions in the bill that have become lightning rods for controversy. They address pensions, Wall Street regulations, and political donations. Depending on one's perspective, they're pragmatic and promote fairness, or they show how money corrupts politics. Joining me in the studio, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, Annie Lowry of New York Magazine, Kevin Hassett of the American Enterprise Institute, and David Leonhardt of the New York Times. I do invite you to be part of the program, as always. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. David Leonhardt, how does this budget process compare with recent years?
Well, in recent years, the process has had a lot of chaos to it. It's involved the government shutdowns that we've all talked about. And so in some ways, this is a little bit back to the way things used to be. This is called the Cromnibus because omnibus is the way the government used to be funded. CR, continuing resolution, is the chaotic things they've been doing, the Band-Aids to get us from one to the next. Both parties basically decided it wasn't in their interest to have chaos this time. The Republicans have just won a sweeping midterm victory. They didn't want to seem as if they're going to then go shut down the government again. The Democrats wanted a deal because they are worried that if they didn't get a year-long deal here for funding, they would get a worse deal come January when the Republicans control both the Senate and the House.
So they funded nearly the entire government, but the Department of Homeland Security only until February. Why is that?
That's right. And so that's the CR part of Cromnibus. That's about Obama's immigration move. So Obama has just announced this executive action to allow several million people to stay in this country without threat of deportation. And Republicans are very angry about that. And so they are funding the Department of Homeland Security only temporarily to have the potential of going back and fighting more. But this is a really hard issue for the Republicans going into 2016 because Obama's move is very popular among Latinos, we now know from polls. And Latinos, while Republicans do not need them in the midterms, did not need them, they probably do need more support from them in 2016 than they got in 2012.
Annie Lowry, tell us about the drama around Senator Ted Cruz and President Obama's immigration action.
Yeah, so he essentially there was some thought that this bill was actually going to pass this morning, but he stood up and basically forced his colleagues to stay over the weekend in order to pass it. And he's grandstanding again, as he has many times over this immigration action. So I don't think that he changed the eventual result, but he did draw a lot of attention to himself through the process, and I think that that's very controversial among his colleagues.
Kevin Hassett, how do you feel about what Ted Cruz had to do?
Well, I think for me, the headline of this process is that it gives us hope for next year, that there's been a deal where people on the left, like Elizabeth Warren, and people on the right, like Ted Cruz, seem really upset about what's going on. And that's normally what happens when you broker a deal with moderates.
Do you think Ted Cruz did himself a favor?
I think that Ted Cruz appeals to people that want a Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of, you know, raging against the machine. I think that that rage doesn't really accomplish much, but it's probably very good for his popularity and his base.
All right. And to you, Michael Greenberger, first of all, how much time did legislators spend studying this bill?
I would say very, very little amount of time. Some of these provisions that have become controversial have been floated in past Congresses. But what happened here is you've got an appropriation bill that's 1,600 pages long. And embedded within it here and there are very controversial substantive amendments that impact laws that are quite important to the American people, so that, first of all, it was difficult to discover what was in the bill because it came up so fast. Then it's so important, it's hard to get people to stop and pay attention to what's happening if you believe that something dramatic has happened. And you've got, on the one hand, are you going to cause a government shutdown? On the other hand, are you going to stop and think about what many people think is very important pieces of legislation?
You said that this is the worst kind of legislating.
Yes, because basically this legislative process is designed to fund the government, not to create substantive requirements for the government. And historically, there have been last-minute deals made that stick in very important substantive pieces of legislation that don't get the consideration they would get if they were treated in what is called regular order. That is to say, they were introduced, they were debated when they were introduced, they went to committees, they were debated before committees, reported to the floor, debated on the floor, where the public and pros and cons are well aired. Here, you don't get that opportunity.
David Leonhardt, briefly, tell us about this pension provision, one of the controversial ones in this.
Yeah, so are you talking more? I'm much more familiar with the Dodd-Frank one. Are you talking about the Dodd-Frank one or the pension one?
No, I'm talking about.
I'll defer to others on the
pension.
All
right, how about the pension provision, Annie?
Right, so it deals with multi-employer pensions. And this is actually, I think, seen as a relatively positive thing in the sense that they've gotten out in front of this issue that there was going to be a problem with the funding of them. But they managed to insert this provision into the bill that would head off, you know, funding problems, basically.
Michael.
Well, I think it is true that there is more consensus over these multi-employer pension provisions than there are over some of the other provisions in the bill. But nevertheless, it's a quite dramatic legislative thrust to increase the payment for pension protection and to give pensions, these multi-employer pension plans, the ability to cut benefits of the pensioners.
And I gather there will be cuts going forward, as well as cuts to the benefits of some 1 million pensioners who are below the age of 75.
Yes. These multi-employer pension plans are prominent in industries that are having financial difficulties, mining, construction, what have you. And instead of having a single employer fund the pension plan, many employers come together to fund it. Many of those employers over time fail, collapse, withdraw. So the sturdiness of these pension plans is very problematic. Nobody argues that these are sturdy plans. Something needs to be done. The question is whether you increase premiums and allow the plans to cut benefits, do that on such short notice without debate, with an impact of possibly millions of people. Is this the way to go about doing something that's very controversial?
Kevin Hassett.
I think that if you're moving legislation, then you should try to accomplish positive things, and that I agree that it'd be, in an ideal world, we would take each thing and then make it a standalone bill and debate it. But sometimes if you have an opportunity to accomplish something good, and we'll debate whether each of these measures we're talking about today was a good thing, but I think you should do it. And this is something that's been going on in Washington for a long time. On the pension plan issue, the basic idea is that for private employers that negotiate a very generous pension with their workers in good times, who then find that they're in bad times, then all of the people that are creditors for that employer are in trouble. You know, that if you lent them money to do something and now they're close to bankruptcy, then you might not get your money back. And so historically what's gone on is that in bankruptcy, people could renegotiate their debts with an employer. But what could happen with these unionized pension plans that were very, very generous benefits, sometimes up around $50,000 a year, that basically the employers made promises to these workers, it's really terrible, that they couldn't keep once they went into bankruptcy. And the problem is that if you look at the pensions that we've guaranteed, that we've got way more guarantee than we have money coming in. And it's a very partisan issue because the unions are very powerful with the Democrats, and the Republicans are, you know, don't want the taxpayers to have to pay for these really large pensions going forward. And so they tried to get ahead of the curve on that one.
What about the people who are already retired, who are counting on this absolute minimum that they are getting, and then they're told it's going to be cut? What do they do, Annie?
It's a really hard question, and it's not just with this set of pensions, it's with a lot of sets of pensions. You know, 40 years from now, we won't be talking so much about these issues because nobody is offering these kinds of pensions anymore. But right now, the question is how to apportion pain. That's really the only kind of way to put it is who is going to bear the burden of these payments? Are the payments going to be reduced, or is somebody going to be forced to pay for them, either the companies, the creditors, the taxpayers?
Annie Lowrey, she's staff writer at New York Magazine, covering politics and economic policy. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. From Lumosity, now with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving to calculate baseline scores. More at lumosity.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
And welcome back. We're talking about several provisions in the omnibus spending bill that was just passed, which takes us through September of 2015, with the exception of the Homeland Security bill, because that carries over only until February. And that is a way for Republicans once again to look at President Obama's immigration statement from the White House. Just before the break, we were talking about these cuts in the pension plans for many of the multi-companies that put together their pensions for employees, say, in the trucking industry, in the construction industry, in others where they put them together into a government-funded pension plan, which is going to take some cuts. We don't know exactly how much, but, Kevin, you speculated it's going to be a hard hit.
Yeah, I can, again, I can think about what I know a little bit about the type of pension that these people are getting and what's going to happen if they default. And I think that you're looking at people, you know, easily going from having pensions in the $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 range to being down around $12,000, that there's a very, very big cut for people whose pension fails once they get swept into the guarantee. And for the, you know, I don't know, we speculate maybe a million people that are affected by this thing. It's severe trauma. It's a, you know, a life-changing event, because you went into retirement expecting one thing, and then all of a sudden you're facing something radically different.
Exactly. We should say, for those over the age of 80 and already retired, they will not be affected. Those between 75 and 80 already receiving the pension will have a lesser cut. Do we know the percentage?
So it looks like the cuts could be up to 30% for current retirees, which is a huge hit if you are on a fixed income.
It's a huge hit. Okay. How did we get to that, Michael?
Well, we got to that because these pensions, which were promised many years ago, were based on the fact that all the employers who joined in would be healthy and wealthy. And after the recession, a lot of these employers have gone bankrupt, gone out of business. You can also back out of these multi-employer plans with a very, what I would call minimal penalty. So simply, you've got maybe $40 billion in liabilities and $1 billion in assets. So something has to be done. And that's why on this issue, even some unions have joined in saying that we need to do something about this.
This is part of a larger issue here, which is, as a society, we've essentially promised substantially richer retirement benefits than we are currently able to pay for. And that's true in the public sector, and it's true in the private sector. And I understand this notion, well, this money has been promised. I'm not talking so much about this particular case, but the larger issue. This money has been promised. It's sacrosanct. We shouldn't touch it. But that's a pretty tricky argument to make, because that means, okay, it means we're going to make deep cuts to schools. It means we're going to make deep cuts to roads. It means essentially none of that stuff is touched and we have to make deep cuts elsewhere. As a country, we already spend more of our national resources on the elderly relative to children than many other rich countries. We already are more heavily focused in that direction. And so one of the questions here is, as Annie said, it's apportioning pain. You'll never hear that from a politician.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Right.
Right. And how do we do that, and what's the fairest way to do it? It is unfair to cut something that people have been promised. It's also unfair to shortchange schools and roads.
And really, lawmakers, and I think we should emphasize that the unions have been leaders, really, in this effort, or some of them, that lawmakers really ultimately face a choice of, with something that's not funded really for a very long time at all, that we basically send these guys checks, and all of a sudden the checks go to zero because the guarantee corporation is in bankruptcy. Or we cut the checks now in order to extend the life of the checks. And I think that for this bill, what they've done is they've studied the issue and come up with a solution that's the best that they can finance.
Yeah, and it's also a sectoral issue. If you look, there's many of these pensions that are doing just fine because the industries that are funding them are doing just fine as well, or because they've made some better investments. But these are hitting industries that have been really hard hit. So, you know, as Michael mentioned, mining and construction. Had we had a strong construction turnaround, this would have been a much smaller issue than it is. And if you look at industries that are doing well, you know, pharmaceuticals, oil and gas, they are not struggling with these issues. And you know, the issue is, you know, if you're an older miner, just a lot of things have gone wrong with that industry
exactly.
for a very long time. So this is a really vulnerable group of people.
All right, let's talk about how the spending bill would change part of the Dodd-Frank Act that deals with derivatives and credit default swaps.
Yes.
David.
So it addresses these swaps, as you say. And this gets highly technical very quickly. So we'll try to focus on the non-technical parts of it. Essentially, banks that take in money have their deposits insured, right? It's the old depression idea that you don't want everyone running to the bank and taking it out. So we insure deposits. The government essentially stands behind them. One of the points of Dodd-Frank was to say, hey, banks, you have a real advantage. The taxpayers are backing you. They are saying those are guaranteed. And you shouldn't be then taking that money and going out and gambling it in ways that if you lose it because you're gambling it rather than because of a bank run, the taxpayers will make you whole. That's not fair. This bill and a provision written by Citigroup lobbyists.
And with calls from Jamie Dimon, two legislators.
With classic examples of lobbying, weakens that. I don't think we yet know how significant it is. It is in the more traditional area of finance, as opposed to the so-called shadow banking system that actually caused more of the problems. But I think this is going to be a continuing attack on financial regulation. Some things in Dodd-Frank. Some of the attack may be good because some of the regulation may have been bad. But much of the attack, I do think, will raise the risks of future problems. And I think we're going to see this play out, obviously, in a political environment. The Republican Party, with the exception of a few people in think tanks, is very comfortable representing Wall Street. The Democratic Party is a little bit more torn. So far, Hillary Clinton seems unlikely to run a populist campaign against Wall Street. And so it's going to be really fascinating
but
to watch.
You've heard Elizabeth Warren speak out so strongly and dramatically on this, Michael.
Well, I have a slightly different take. I don't think what was prohibited by Dodd-Frank and which is now allowed is in the classic mode of what banks do. Besides credit default swaps, they were banned from being dealers in commodity swaps, agricultural swaps, energy swaps, oil swaps. Stop for a minute and just think. Oil has gone from over $100 a barrel to $60 a barrel. That's a very volatile market. These swaps are essentially bets on the direction of prices. When the market veers and out of ordinary ranges, people lose lots of money. And the theory here is that not only the banks have their depositors insured up to $250,000, let's just say for simple, but also when they get into trouble, they can go to the Fed window and get loans at very inexpensive rates. And there were many, many loans made in the wake of the 2008 depression. And those loans essentially were backed by the taxpayers. Now, some people say, well, you look at the Lehman Brothers, AIG, they didn't have FDIC insurance. But what happened was Morgan Stanley, Goldman didn't have FDIC insurance, and they switched over to a status as a U.S. bank holding company, so they do have FDIC insurance. But the FDIC insurance is nickels and dimes compared to the amount of money we threw at banks to save them from catastrophe during the 2008. The final point I would make is our policy at that point was banks made bad deals and didn't have the money to pay off their obligations. What do we do? Do we say to the banks, well, that's tough luck, or we'll let you pay a little bit off? We said, no, we'll give you the money to pay everything off. With these elderly people who are going to lose pensions, by the way, a lot less money than the banks were losing, we're saying to them, you're on your own.
So, Kevin, does this not put taxpayers on the hook once again if banks begin to resume risky investments?
I think it's very important to clarify what they just did. And I think that we could argue about Dodd-Frank. In fact, we should have a whole different show about Dodd-Frank. But the specifics of what just happened are really, really minor. Because basically what's going on is that we had a Dodd-Frank had a condition that the derivatives had to be spun off into a subsidiary of the parent. So you can think about it. Kevin creates, Kevin Jr. Incorporated, and I throw my derivatives in there, but it's still a part of Kevin. And so the issue is just like really there are two ways that the feds were going to guarantee Kevin Jr. or Kevin, however it happened anyway. One is just that since Kevin's systemically important, if Kevin Jr. starts to bring him down, what's really going to happen? But the second is that for derivative contracts, that basically there's a federal guarantee for them anyway, even at the clearinghouses, or the derivative clearinghouses. And my colleague Paul Kupiak is writing about this right now. And the reason is that you put up collateral when you have a derivative. And the problem is that if the person who can claim the collateral needs to because there's a default, then all of a sudden you run into a fire sale risk where everybody's getting their collateral from the derivative, selling it all at once, the price of the collateral's collapsing, and then everybody looks like they're failing. And so what's going on in the derivative market already is that there's a federal backstop, a guarantee to keep people from having the fire sale of the assets if someone's calling for the collateral. And so there's kind of two levels of guarantee that are in place even after this change. What they're really doing is just making them not go through the bureaucratic costs of transferring the stuff from Kevin to Kevin Jr., which looked like it was just window dressing, I think, to lawmakers, which is why President Obama said he didn't support it, but he was willing to do this. And I think, again, if it was anywhere near as big a change as Elizabeth Warren seems to be claiming, then I don't think that, you know, President Obama, the Democrats would have made the deal that they did.
I think that's a very serious misrepresentation of what's going on. First of all, the Kevin Jr. here will not have FDIC-insured deposits. The Kevin Jr. in this case will not be able to go to the Fed window and get interest-free loans to get you out of trouble. That's why the banks don't like this. They want to do risky investments in an environment where they make profits, they take the profits home. When they have destroying losses, the American taxpayer pays the bill. And also, you can talk about clearing, but this is uncleared credit default swaps. Specifically, if they're cleared credit default swaps, they can stay in the bank. If they're uncleared credit default swaps, they go to Kevin Jr. So therefore, you've got the most dangerous kind of investments that are not guaranteed by a middleman being subject to horrific losses. And what will the loss be? We won't be asking banks to take a little bit of a loss like we're asking our pensioners. We'll be telling the banks, how much money do you need to get out of this problem?
Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Annie Lowry.
So I think that one of the issues, and it gets to the complexity of what we've been talking about, is we're not exactly going to know how the system is going to play out until we have another financial crisis. I think that there is, I realize that that's kind of crazy to say, but the question here is who is going to come in to backstop losses for what and where?
Precisely.
And I think that this is perhaps symbolically important because and there's been a big symbolic fight over it, because this seems to imply that the banks are getting away with somewhat what they got away with before the financial crisis, that they are writing their own rules, that their lobbying remains really powerful in Washington. And I think that is the vein of liberal anger that Elizabeth Warren is tapping into. I agree that again, this might be a relatively small provision, but again, it comes to the broader question of who's going to be backstopping what. And that's why the FDIC-insured portion is so important of this, right? If you are somebody who has, a taxpayer guarantee that you're going to have certain assets that are going to be protected, should you be allowed to be making these risky bets?
Is this a win for Wall Street, David Leonhardt?
Yes. I mean, Citigroup and Jamie Dimon wouldn't have been spending their time on it if they didn't care about it and it didn't matter. I also agree that this is not the end of Dodd-Frank. I think this is a skirmish in what is going to be a big battle over many years. I mean, there's this famous line that Warren Buffett has where people say, you know, Warren Buffett accused people of launching class warfare. There is class warfare and my class is winning, right? And it's a funny line. It's a classic Warren Buffett line, and that it captures the essence of something in a blunt way. And I would say essentially there's always been a big fight around finance and around Wall Street. Wall Street has won the vast majority of those fights. They've come out of the financial crisis quite strong, remarkably strong, and they're going to keep pushing to be stronger.
But isn't it now beyond debate that swaps led to the 2008 financial crisis? Or is there still a great deal of debate about that?
With apologies for sounding Bill Clintonian, it depends on what your definition of lead is, right? Played a role. I would argue that they did not play a dominant role, but I think they played a role that mattered.
Significant.
Yes.
I would say they played a dominant role. I think the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the majority report makes it clear they played a dominant role. Everybody who's looked at this issue and issued an official report has said, essentially, credit default swaps are betting that mortgages would not be paid. Everybody was betting that mortgages would be paid. But some people, as Michael Lewis showed in the book The Big Short, bet that mortgages wouldn't be paid. And trillions of dollars of naked credit default swaps were taken out. Paulson, who was a hedge fund manager in New York, made $4 billion in 2007 betting that mortgages wouldn't be paid. You could have somebody betting on a single house nine times that the mortgage wouldn't be paid, just like you could have people betting, nine people betting that the New York Giants won't beat the Washington Redskins. The failure to have the money to pay those bets led to the meltdown. To diminish that is really, I think, remarkable.
All right. We've got to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll talk further about Dodd-Frank and other issues. Take your calls. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering matching holiday pajamas for the entire family, even the cats and dogs. Over 17 family sets online in knits, fleece, and flannel at pajamagram.com. From Athena Health, committed to helping physicians manage industry change so they can focus on patient care. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services at athenahealth.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, home ownership has dropped to the lowest rate in 20 years. New research finds renting makes more financial sense for half of current American homeowners. Rethinking the benefits of buying a house. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Kathy in Sarasota, Florida. You're on the air.
I wanted to make a statement that if you read Hank Paulson's books, and he was Bush's Secretary of Treasury, he clearly states that the faults that he finds is that the administration paid no attention to the newer, sophisticated investment instruments being sold on Wall Street. So he himself does claim that you know, Bush's administration should have been paying more attention to what was going on.
Michael.
It's a high irony that swaps were completely deregulated on a rider to an 11,000-page omnibus appropriation bill in 2000 on the last day of a lame duck Congress. House passed it in the morning, Senate passed in the afternoon, no regulations. So when Hank Paulson says we didn't know what was happening, these bets were not being covered by the banks, but nobody had any record of it.
Kevin.
You know, it's a very complicated space because we all would agree that it would make sense to use derivatives. For example, we talked about the big collapse in oil prices to insure yourself against big price swings. And so looking at a book and figuring out, you know, is this insurance or are they speculating is something that's a pretty challenging thing to do.
David.
The reason why I think I don't want to exaggerate the role that swaps play is they played a role. They were the instruments. It's true that they were in the dark. Here's what wasn't in the dark. Banks were lending money to people for mortgages that people couldn't repay. Mm-hmm. Banks were leveraged at an unbelievable level. Banks were taking enormous risks. That wasn't in the dark. We had a classic bubble that took over much of society that was huge on Wall Street. Alan Greenspan missed that. Much of the Fed missed it, including Ben Bernanke. And so I just would want to avoid saying there's this secret little thing off in this corner that caused the whole crisis. It played a role, but only a role.
Yeah.
It was the agent of chaos rather than the chaos itself.
My response to that would be that mm-hmm. mortgages, if only mortgages failed, we would have a serious economic problem. When nine people are betting on a single mortgage failing, the person who's betting that the mortgage will be paid is in serious difficulty. So the swaps magnified the losses to a large extent. And if you just had mortgages failing and not nine people behind the mortgages betting whether or not they would fail, we would have had a serious recession. Instead, we went to the brink of the Great Depression.
And this is the point of agreement for us that you could look at, one of these things that would happen would be that I would pay you $100 if somebody defaulted, say, that would be the contract that we'd be trading. And if you look at the explosion of these markets, for some foreign governments, there were more swaps like that, there were more guarantees than the government had debt. By a factor of 9 or 10. And so that the fact that people were playing this sort of betting market on the side where they were betting, you know, trading guarantees for debt that didn't exist did actually magnify this. But I side with David in the sense that I think that in the end we have to, you know, put the lion's share of the blame on the mortgages that couldn't be paid back.
All right. Here's an email, and apparently there are many like this regarding pensions. Everyone forgets these retirement programs were contracts between employee and employer. The employee took a lower salary for the promise of a comfortable retirement. The employer promised to fund these plans. What's happened since the 70s is that executive salaries have skyrocketed at the expense of the line worker and lower and middle management. Annie.
I think that gets to something really important. This is not fair. It's absolutely not fair. This is breaking a contract that existed between employer and employee. Unfortunately, the money that has gone to executives is already out the door. And, you know, there's just not enough money to go around. And it's really, really unfortunate. And the question is, who's going to be on the hook for it?
And it looks as though the taxpayer is going to be on the hook.
Yeah. And the pension.
The pension.
Exactly.
But that is the problem here, right? A company and a worker agree to a deal. They sign a contract. And then guess what? The company doesn't have the money to pay the worker. And so a society has to make a decision. Do taxpayers make the company's promise good? Is the worker essentially cheated of what he was promised?
Yeah, do contracts matter anymore?
Right. But what's tricky about this is we're not talking about whether the company has some money that they're hiding that they not pay. We're talking about the company's gone or doesn't have the money. Do the rest of us come in and make the worker whole? And I think there's an argument that we should, but there's also this tricky situation in which the contract wasn't between the taxpayers and the worker.
Yeah. In that 2008, we paid far more money to banks who couldn't honor their contracts. Trillions and trillions of dollars. The shortfall here is nowhere near that. And people are not paying the taxes that they should be paying. When you save the taxpayers' money, these executives that are taking home huge salaries are paying a very low proportion of taxes.
All right. Here's another email from Kurt in Freeburg, in Byron, Illinois. The Dodd-Frank and campaign finance provisions were nothing less than a big wet kiss to Wall Street, and the 1% for their campaign contributions for the last election. Who put those provisions in the bill is what Kurt is asking.
I think in many cases we don't know.
Yeah. The guess would be some staffer on the Appropriations Committee who was responsible for putting the bill together just tossed in things that they thought would be goodies for people who had supported their boss's election. That's why this kind of legislating in a very short period of time, not using regular order, not having hearings, not having debates, is so terrible. Some of this stuff, if it had been debated, maybe it would have passed anyway. But my thinking is, if it was brought to the light of day, it would never have passed.
Is there anything good in here for the average American? An emailer from New York says, or was the average American helped or hurt by this budget? David.
Well, I'll say briefly and then defer to Annie. Look, government shutdowns are bad for the average American. They're bad for the economy.
Yeah, but what about this budget?
It's amazing that the spending in the bill is the least controversial part. And I think David's right. At the very least, there's some certainty that the government is going to be funded through the remainder of the fiscal year. That's the best thing. And notably, the spending in the bill was not actually very controversial because it hews really, really closely to agreements that were previously made by Republicans and Democrats very painfully through a very messed up budget process. So I think that's the upshot, so much as there's one.
So Kevin Drum, who's a liberal writer, has a piece called Here's What Democrats Got Out of the Cromnibus, which, to be clear, is different from what the average American got. But he has sort of a populist take on it. He says there's a lot of money for early childhood development in it. While the EPA got hit in some ways, the EPA also got a lot of what it needed. There's money for national security requirements, like fighting ISIS. There's money to fight the Ebola epidemic. There's money for a manufacturing institutes initiative. So it's a huge bill. It's got a fair amount of good and a fair amount of bad in it. And my guess is we can all disagree about what the good and the bad are.
That the campaign finance part is good for the average American. And here's why. That if you think about the state that we have right now, we have super PACs where they spend lots and lots of money, unbounded amounts of money, but at least you can see who the contributors are. We have C4 organizations where basically, you know, dark groups of people can come in and influence elections and we don't know who they are. And then we have the traditional party apparatus where if you give money to it, then we can see who you are. And we had put a lot of constraints on contributions to that one. And if we relax those constraints, then my view is that probably what's going to happen is that a lot of the money that used to go into the C4s that were dark and the super PACs are going to go to the parties and be more transparent. And so I would say even the campaign finance move, that I agree that there's a campaign finance reform that I might prefer, but relative to where we were a month ago, I think it's an improvement for the average American.
So what about that, Michael? Talk about campaign finance and how the provision in this omnibus bill is affecting campaign finance.
Well, essentially, campaign finance is in complete disarray, mostly because the Supreme Court has invalidated most of the campaign finance prohibitions. And so the argument that Kevin is making, look, this is all a wreck anyway. People are giving money and we don't know who they are. This allows people to give a lot of money and we'll know who they are. The overall situation is not very good. And I would say the campaign finance bill, especially if you were saying people could increase their donations from $177,000 to $900,000, that would, if you just said that on the floor of a house where there was time to think about it, that would not be very popular.
Maybe it's worth just clarifying what the provision does. So it says that if you are an individual, there's new funds, or actually I don't know if they're existing or new, but there's three funds in the DNC and the RNC, and you can give $97,200 a year to each of them. So that works out to $324,000 a year for an individual. And so I'm with Kevin, in the sense that it's good to know who is giving what. It's good to have that money be somewhat transparent. But I still think that if you are somebody who has hundreds of millions of dollars, this is just increasing the amount of money that you can hypothetically give.
Okay, so
I don't think that it really helps.
A donor now is held to $97,200, but under party limits would be able to give $777,600.
But they're going to be able to give that money. That's where I disagree with Annie, is that they will be able to give that money to something that will influence the election. Now, if they're more likely to give it to the transparent thing that goes through the normal party. And also, I think that the parties often have a moderating influence, that they pick candidates that are less crazy and so on. So letting the parties be a little better funded,
but
I don't think
giving,
is bad.
They're giving money where the parties really need it. Both parties really wanted this thing. If somebody gives $700,000 to a party who really needs that money for a convention, let's say, that's the kind of person who, when you have these omnibus bills and are throwing in these little darts, is going to call a staffer and say, this is my payback. Do this.
I think that's right. We're having a lot of interesting debates here. How important were swaps to the financial crisis? Is it better to have sunlight and more money, or have that money go in the dark? I think wherever you are on those debates, to me, one of the common threads here, in a time of really high inequality, enormous inequality, we really do see a situation in which people with the resources, people who've done very well, are having a very large influence on the political process.
All right. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Jeffrey in New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you.
My first point is that you have some guests who are very qualified, but why do you keep on inviting people from the American Enterprise Institute in Cato when it's well known that these are just funded by the Koch brothers?
Please, if you have a specific question,
yes,
rather than an ad hominem comment.
No, I'm saying that the comments that your guest is making from the American Enterprise Institute about $50,000 being an outrageous promise for a pension, in the United States, $50,000 is nothing.
All right, and that's a point.
Well, I think that he just misrepresented what I said. What I said is that if you make a very a generous pension promise and then you can't keep it, then that person has got a negative surprise that's terrible. In fact, you remember, Diane, I talked about how terrible it is for that person. And we all, as a panel, said, how is that pain going to be allocated? Should the taxpayers step in every time that somebody loses something like that? I think it's a difficult question. They tried to balance the taxpayer and the pensioner benefit in this bill.
And to Stephanie in Syracuse, Indiana, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I wanted to make the point of the hypocritical nature between saving the taxpayers' money with the pensioners, but going ahead and being liable for the financial institution. But you guys already covered that. So I guess what I would like to say is, as a taxpayer, I have no problem with money going to pension shortfalls, but I don't want one red cent going to the financial sector.
Well, I think that sentiment is a sentiment that is well stated, and being well stated, not just from Democrats or progressives, but from Republicans. As I said earlier, David Vitter was one of a Republican senator from Louisiana, was very outspoken against the Dodd-Frank rider here. I think that when you ask what are the good things that come out of this legislation, I think the good things that come out of this legislation are that people are learning how terrible things can happen without a lot of thought, influenced by people who are not worried about whether they're going to get their pension benefits.
explain to me quickly, David Lee and the Heart, there were nearly 100 riders in the budget bill. How did they get there?
Well, so in many cases, we don't know, right? We don't know who put them there. But when you have one of these bills that is sprawling and touches essentially every aspect of government, as part of the process, you have members of Congress, you have their staffers put provisions in the bill. Sometimes that's because it's an issue they've been working on forever and care about. Sometimes it's because they get a call from a campaign donor or a constituent. And it is, for better and worse, the way legislation is made.
I must say, except for Michael, the three of you seem fairly blasé about what's happened here. It strikes me that people listening to this program have a certain different take, that Wall Street got a lot and the American people got very little.
I think that, you know, if Timothy Geithner or Jamie Dimon were here on this panel, I think that what they would say to Michael is that Wall Street got loans that were necessary to stabilize the financial system for the good of the economy as a whole, and that they paid those loans back. We will debate that endlessly.
Annie Lowry of New York Magazine, Kevin Hassett of AEI, David Leonhardt of the New York Times, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland. We will continue to debate this. Thank you all.
Thank you.
For listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted.